a really banging Twilight Football to kick off your Wednesday afternoon. Hello and welcome. My name is Ed Gooden. Alongside me, very shortly, there we are, Josh Parrish. Welcome to the stream, man.
Goodness me.
Goodness me. What a rock solid way to start your afternoon.
I think we had a more event-laden, incident-prone opening to this show than Scotland had to their Euro 2020 campaign.
I wonder what our XG was, though. Expected broadcast. It was looking shabby there from about 6:15 onwards. Josh, what's the plan for this evening?
Well, we're going to talk Euros. We're going to talk the Euros so far, and we're going to talk the Euros with the people who helped us predict the Euros before it started. We're going to check in with our tipping competition and give our thoughts on the contenders thus far. Teo Pelletieri and Damir Kulash, looking hauntingly transparent at the moment, are with us. Gentlemen, good evening.
Good evening, Josh. Great to be back.
It's great to have you guys. How are your sleep patterns adjusting? Are you fully nocturnal yet, Teo?
Just about. I was actually saying to some people this afternoon that Italy-Switzerland, it doesn't grab me as the 5 a.m. kickoff, so tonight might be a quote-unquote early night, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see how my football manager addiction is holding up, and that may actually determine whether I make the kickoff or not.
Damir, you're pushing on through for a triple header tonight?
I can't say I am, particularly with work in the morning. So I'd be lucky to get through one game, at best one and a half. But it will be exciting nonetheless. Although I'm not sure I agree with Teo's assertion that Italy-Switzerland is the least interesting of the three games tonight. I think it's actually probably the most high quality of the three, and in essence might actually be the most fun.
Well, we know your enthusiasm for Balkan teams.
Congratulations on making history as the first person to say a game with Switzerland in it is fun in prospect. you must be a lot higher on that game than I am.
Damir, it hasn't been a good tournament so far for Eastern Europe. A lot of the sort of traditional Western powers doing the business, and some even non-traditional ones as well. What do you put that down to?
Good question. I think that quality-wise, you've got a lot of teams from, you know, that region that are in the pits in terms of where they're at. You look at particularly Russia has been on a downhill trend since really the 2018 World Cup. They had a good few months after it, but since then they really haven't looked like the same team that we saw in 2018. Wonder why. You can draw your own conclusions. the Ukraine was unlucky. North Macedonia, I think, are potentially the weakest or, you know, one of the weakest teams in the tournament, and beating a much improved Austria to the one that we saw in 2016 was always going to be a tough ask. The team that I think has been quite disappointing for a second straight tournament, though, is Poland. I know they were a bit unlucky with potentially the Kubiak red card. Two competing trains of thought with that one. Was it harsh? Was it not? I thought it was. But still, you know, the fact that they've lost 2-1 to and seemingly inferior team in Slovakia is not a good sign for them. And neither is the fact that Robin Lewandowski is still failing to fire. Croatia, we saw against England, were not great. But you expect them to look better in their next two group games. So I won't pass judgment on them until I see them at least in their next game against the Czech Republic, who I must admit is the, you know, sole flag bearers for actually Eastern Europe doing quite well at this tournament following their 2-0 win against Scotland. Undeserved, some might say, but they did take their chances, and boy, did Patrick Schick look good.
Patrick Schick did look good, and not traditionally so, looking great from the halfway line, which is not something we always say. Probably the biggest or the saddest thing for me for Poland is the fact that Robin Lewandowski, like you said, is not getting on the board. I don't know, I've probably got 10 different people I know who have a multi on that involves Robert Lewandowski being the top goal scorer. So I think that might be...
Well, they obviously didn't listen to our tournament preview then, because we comprehensively wrote off the polls.
As you should most of the time, to be honest. Historically, they haven't done fantastic. Last night, we had an interesting string of games. Spain against Sweden, Hungary and Portugal, and then France, Germany. France and Germany was, Germany this year, They're almost going into it as a dark horse, obviously one of the bigger names, but just falling short to France. What's the breakdown on those three games for you, Tay?
I thought Hungary, Portugal was great entertainment, and Hungary were building towards scoring the first goal and winning that game. It was a fairly clear offside for the goal that they had disallowed, and then Portugal, little slice of luck with the deflection to score the opener, and then with momentum and Hungary demoralised, ran away with it. But I thought the actual quality of the play and the fact that Hungary, their game plan really up until the 85th minute was executed perfectly. They held on in the first half, restricted Portugal's attacking capabilities, and then just grew in confidence as the second half went on. When you're the underdog, the clear underdog in all three games, they pretty much showed their hand as to how they might have to approach the France and Germany games as well. And I don't think Germany were very impressive. I did say in the preview that their only sort of proper striker in the team was Kevin Volland, and otherwise they are just a team of attacking midfielders. It almost, like, I know that there's been a lot of talk about the end of Joachim Löw's reign as manager and how this is his goodbye tournament. But I think really there needs to be an institutional shift from the Germans as well. It still irks me no end, and it feels like we are stuck in 2015 or 2016 whenever they announce a squad and they don't have forwards as an option. It's almost like they've stalled in 2015 and they think that tiki-taka and dominating possession is going to be the future of football forever. And there's almost an, hey, Germans and arrogance. There's almost an arrogance to that, which I think needs to be moved on from under Hansi Flick, and a reinvestment in the idea of having actual strikers rather than just a totally interchangeable team. Oh, credit to France for beating them. And all they need to do is just time their runs a little bit better, and they're going to blow teams away. And you know, they're a really good show to beat Portugal in the group and top the group based on last night's showing. Just a few little tweaks with their attacking movement in order to stop getting caught offside.
Killian, mate, you're faster than everybody. Just give yourself a metre. Just a metre.
Just run.
You've got to beat them to the ball anyway. Ah, jeez. It was still pretty exhilarating to see him burst past German defenders, even if he was offside on a couple of occasions. But Germany, for me, they seem to be so out of step, and this is probably Jogi Löw's fault majority of the time, but they seem to be playing in such a divergent style to what has been the predominant focus in the Bundesliga over the last few years, with the pressing and counter-pressing and counter-attacking and the end-to-end nature of the Bundesliga. It's as if Jogi Löw didn't win it the way he quite wanted to win it in 2014, and famously went for that run on the beach after they struggled to beat Algeria in extra time, and decided that they had to go back to a more conservative counter-attacking approach for the France game that they did so well with in 2010. Now he's got one. He wants to win a major tournament the right way, and yeah, it's. I agree with you, Teo. A little bit outdated. As for Hungary, I was just just amazed to see a full stadium full of people. Like, it was quite jarring.
And well, just on that point, I wanted to bring Demir in on this, because after Spain's run, and then after Germany won the 2014 World Cup, it looked as though those two national teams, especially given what was going on in youth national teams and youth Euros, were set to dominate international football for the next decade, if not longer. And Spain, of the big contending teams, were also quite unimpressive and passive in the way that they played in their game against Sweden, which was, you know, probably the most nil-all of the nil-all draws so far. So, Demir, what are your thoughts on Germany, but also your thoughts on Spain? And are either of these teams capable of correcting course mid-tournament? Because I don't think either of them are. I think that, you know, a team like Croatia will improve. A team like Scotland could turn it around after defeat in the opening game. I'm not so sure that we're going to see better from Spain or Germany.
Yeah, they both seem to be quite rigid. And also the fact of the matter is that they're not very flexible. I mean, you also look at their squads and, you know, how many of those Spanish or German players would you say are, one, world-class, or B, the best in their position? Not too many. Whereas when you look at teams like France, you know, you could make an argument of England, Italy, not so much, but a lot of their players are developing and transitioning into that stage and have still got the best years ahead of them. Whereas, yeah, with both Spain and Germany, it's just not working at the moment. And there are a number of reasons as to why. But it just seems like that they've stuck to the old methods of what made them so successful earlier on in the last decade, and those methods are no longer attainable to essentially achieve the same success. You can't replicate them now in order to win major tournaments, particularly when you've got a France team that, as you've noted, is quite a top-heavy when it comes to going forward. And also, you've just, you know, you need to take more risks, and I don't believe either of those two teams are. And when you look at the Germany squad, particularly the issues that they're having up front, they are really missing a Miroslav Klose type. And I sometimes think that, you know, we mentioned Poland beforehand. Gee, imagine Robert Lewandowski in that team and what he'd be able to do with better players around him and as a pivot to a number of players around him that also play with him at a club level.
So the other thing I wanted to follow up on was, which, and Josh and Ed, by all means, weigh in, which of the teams that lost in this first round of matches turns it around in game two? Because if I can hark back to the preview show, I was the resident normie. I picked on name recognition, and I picked against Turkey, and I picked against Ukraine. I didn't fall in to the fashionable dark horse picks. I actually had them both getting knocked out of the group stage, and I'm feeling pretty good about that because they're now one more slip up away from potentially going home. But yeah, I wanted to throw it out there. Which of the losers from the first round of games would you say corrects course and not just goes through from the group, but could still actually contend rather than, say, squeaking out of the group as one of the best third place teams only to be offered up as a sacrifice in the round of 16?
I want to say Scotland, but the last part of your question halts me very, very quickly. I think Scotland will turn it around and they'll get some sort of a result.
Against England?
Potentially so.
We did flag that.
Yeah. The team that I think will turn it around, and I have no reason to think this because, again, I didn't watch them play and everything that you guys were saying probably goes against this. But for some reason, I want Spain to be back to where they were when they won those two international competitions in a row.
I don't know. I'm sort of over it, to be honest. Against Sweden, I felt Sweden should have won that match. It was 0-0, but the coach bringing Alexander Isak off just destroyed any potential attacking threat that they had at their disposal. And Spain, you know, they missed a few good chances, but I'm just not sure you win an international tournament with Alvaro Morata up front.
No, they're just... Something that gets me with Spain is just how slow they are. Mm. I just don't think they have that much pace. But even
I think it's the ball movement that's so slow. I'm not sure if it's the players themselves. I mean, Ferran Torres is very quick. You know, they've got a few quick players. Adama Traore, you know, he's pretty quick.
Yeah.
I think it's just the ball movement makes
not
them look slow.
Utilizing it.
But in terms of the teams that have lost, I'll go back to my fashionable dark horse pick and say Ukraine. I thought they showed enough in that Netherlands performance to suggest that against, you know, the weaker opposition that they have in their group, North Macedonia coming up tomorrow night, aside from the sort of emotional pull of their first major tournament appearance, I didn't think they were that impressive against Austria and scored really a comedy goal. I think Ukraine will win that game and I think they'll go through.
Where do we put Holland then? If Ukraine are the dark horse, as you say, and they put in a good performance, where do you put the Netherlands then?
I want to hear which team Demir is choosing as his turn it around candidate.
Before I do, I must say I'm quite disappointed in Josh that he didn't thump the table there. look, I think that Ukraine showed enough in their game against the Netherlands to indicate that there's life in them, and that while they are, you know, while they do concede quite a lot of chances, they are an attacking team who I think will get the better of both Austria and North Macedonia in their remaining two games. Turkey will be playing essentially two de facto home games when you consider the fact that they'll be playing in Baku. And for that matter, I think that they should get the better of both Wales and Switzerland. So I predict both those teams to go through. As to who has a better chance of challenging, I mean, it's tough. I'm still leaning towards the Ukraine just because I believe that they are a better team. I think that there was a lot in that game against Italy to raise legitimate concerns about Turkey's chances of going quite far in this tournament. So I'm going to stick to the Ukraine.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm a little bit worried about Turkey from what I saw in game one. The lack of ambition was so striking. Mm. You know, Italy were quite impressive in that fixture, but they had so much of the ball and so much of the territory, and Turkey barely got beyond the halfway line for most of that game. And the substitution they made at halftime just made it so, so much worse with Izizi coming off. So I didn't think the coach covered himself in glory either with the changes he made.
Why would that have happened? Because we've mentioned in qualifying how good they looked.
Well, he just brought the wrong player off. He was bringing in Under at halftime to give them a little bit more of a pacey option out wide and some threat in transition, but he brought off the only midfielder who could pass the ball to him. So he just...
He was too conservative.
He brought off their ball-playing midfielder instead of one of their defensive midfielders, and they just lost the ability to feed Under the ball, essentially. Mm. What about Croatia, Damir? They looked so sluggish against England. I think most people have written them off as too old and too slow and, not really gelling as a team. And, they've still got loads and loads of talent in that squad. Some players... could be perhaps dropped after the opening game defeat. Do you think they're a chance of a revival?
I wouldn't rule out Croatia. I don't think it's smart to count against them, as you saw during the course of the last World Cup. And England knew that quite well when they thought that Croatia would be tied in the semi-final. I think that there was enough in that England game to highlight that the midfield is, of course, their strong point. Of course, when you have a player like Luka Modric, Celo Brozovic and Mateo Kovacic, as well as guys like Mario Pašalić and also Nikola Vlasic to come off it, that there is plenty of quality in that department. I guess it's really a question of where do the goals come from. Perisic is always an option. Rebic isn't a goal game striker, but he can definitely slot them in, as can Kramaric, who hasn't really sort of filled the shoes left by Mario Mandžukić following his retirement post 2018. So I think that's a big question. I mean, Petkovic has looked good when he's been played as the number nine, but he doesn't quite exactly have the quality of someone like Kramaric or even Brekalo from who, of course, plays in the Bundesliga. So it's really a question of, in this next game against the Czech Republic, they're going up against a team who, while confident, won't be as desperate for a result as they are. So I think Croatia will bounce back in that game and set up a potentially decisive final group victory against Scotland and Hampden Park.
That group's looking very, very tasty. Mm. Where do you want to go next, Ed? Who are you?
I want to raise a point. A real pet hate of mine about this continental Euros has been the variance in climate and conditions in all of the different cities. One of the reasons it feels so different and feels to me like a bit of a lesser tournament as opposed to a bit of a series of games is you go from cold and windy Hampden Park to boiling hot Seville to the Eurasian climate of Baku, and it was even, they were saying it was warm in England, 27 degrees, take it or leave it, but it was
hot
warm
ass.
In the sense that it was 27, but it was direct sunlight. Mm. And if Mark Schwarzer says it's hot, an Australian, which is what he said on the Optus coverage with Amy Chapman, then yes, it's hot.
Mm.
I feel as though there's almost, I know teams are getting home ground advantage and Hungary got it to their advantage, Demir mentioned that, in Azerbaijan, the Turks will have it to their advantage. That's not so much of a problem for me as it is just the incredible variance with the different games. Mm. It almost feels like there should be a home and away element to some of these contests because it does seem absurd to go from windy, cold Scotland to boiling hot Spain all in the space of the same group. And I think that's one of the charms of having the tournament in one country in a far more confined geographic space. And I'm actually a little bit... I know the England game has been overanalyzed by the wider media, so, of course, they're going to be talking about it a lot more. That has, to an extent, been done to death, but only in the isolation of it being the England game. And if Croatia are going to Hampden Park for Game 3, it's not going to feel like the same tournament by the time they get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're playing against Czech Republic at Hampden Park in Game 2, and where are they for game 3 against Scotland? It's that's Hampden Park as well. So two games in nice chilly Glasgow for them to maybe rest some tired legs.
Well, if England make it through to the final, they will only have to play one game outside of the UK.
Well, it depends on the draw, I guess.
But isn't that kind of astounding to think about?
Well, I mean, that's always the case for a host nation. It's just the fact that, you know, this is
but if like there's a draw, but really. If there's a club like or a country like, I mean, I don't know the specifics, but if this is the case, like Wales, for example, that are going to hot Spain.
I mean, there's going to be a massive variance in terms of the travel times for teams, depending on where they finish in the group and who they draw in the knockout stages. It's going to be major advantages and disadvantages, but it's just hard to predict who that's going to favour, aside from the teams that are home in the group stages. Of these upcoming fixtures, which one are you most excited to watch in match day two?
It's probably not top of my list, but how absurd is it that if Finland even get a draw tonight, they're probably through.
I love that so much.
In terms of minutes and seconds, Josh, do you recall how long we spent talking about the Finns in our Euro preview show?
About 10 seconds.
I'm pretty sure it was zero for both.
0 seconds.
0 seconds. So, look, it's probably not in terms of the football, no, but just in terms of the storyline. I mean, imagine if the Finns win tonight and they're on 6 points and they're guaranteed a spot in the next round.
Well, there's a Twitch-verse participant called FM Scrolls who is part Finnish, and he's been supporting them every single stream that we do, even non-Euros related, and he's mentioned that this game against Russia is massive for any Finnish fan just because there's that historical significance of Russia, you know, trying to creep their way into the country every now and then.
I reckon Finland should be able to annex part of Russia if they win tonight.
Yeah.
So should we put something extra on the line?
Why not?
Sorry, Josh Putin. I was not that excited is the right word, but I guess it's going to be intriguing to just see that Belgium-Denmark game and to see how Denmark responds to really an unprecedented event. I mean, none of their players have experienced anything like it in the past, and we haven't really seen anything similar in a major tournament. I mean, 2003 in the Confederations Cup in France, the death of Marc Vivien Foe. Of course, France and Cameroon played out the final. It was quite an eerie occasion. And, yeah, just it'll be interesting to see what Parken Stadium is like tomorrow night when those two teams meet, because for Denmark, of course, they lost their first game. So they could be heading into that game against Belgium knowing that another defeat will make it very, very difficult for them to actually progress through into the knockout stages. But then again, do they actually even really care? Because you know, I think the Christian Eriksen incident has really put things into perspective that ultimately, at the end of the day, it is just a game. And as Arrigo Sacchi once said, football is the most important, the least important things in life. And, you know, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Can I, just on that point, though, Demir, I actually think, while it may not necessarily be a galvanising force, I think that perspective may help the Danes because while it's not the same circumstances as the only other time they won the Euro, it is something so out of the ordinary that it's almost in keeping of the nation's character that these sort of, you know, previously it was a war breaking out. This time it's the near-death experience of one of their teammates. It are these things that make the football side of things secondary to what goes on in life that gives that perspective to what they're doing.
Obviously a positive as well. Obviously a positive as well for them is knowing that, you know, we saw the tweet from Christian Eriksen giving a thumbs up. Obviously that doesn't mean everything, but at least he's smiling and he's able to watch. So I'm sure that would raise their spirits as well a little bit.
Yeah, I'm sure they've spoken to him as well. I mean, you know, does it, I guess, make them the neutrals' favourite, the sentimental storyline to hopefully see Denmark do well, you know,
it'd be
in
amazing,
spite of
wouldn't it?
The traumatic experience that they've gone through, don't you?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, despite Belgium's star power and really, you know, I think for a lot of neutrals, Belgium are an exciting and entertaining team to watch because the likes of Lukaku, De Bruyne, Hazard and so on. I think a lot of people will, you know, really take to the Danes in this game. I mean, Teo mentioned 1992. And if you recall back to 1992, their striker Kim Wilfort was really playing in that tournament, really traumatic time for him because he had a young daughter who, you know, had to work. She'd been diagnosed with leukemia and she wasn't given much of a chance to survive. Her condition was deteriorating and he, you know, played through it and ultimately scored the sealing goal in Sweden. So, you know, there are certain parallels to 92 with this team and, you know, perhaps football being not at the forefront of their minds at the moment. But, yeah, that'll be an interesting occasion tomorrow evening at Parker Stadium. I guess the obvious one, of course, is England-Scotland. There's, you know, over 150 years of history between them two in international football. I think the first ever international football game was played between the two. And, you know, you don't often see them playing in a competitive fixture. I know that they met in qualifying for the 2018 World Cup, if I recall correctly. But outside of that, Euro 96 brings back some fond memories for the English fans, not so much for the Scottish fans of that day. I do wonder if the Scots, not feeling as much pressure as the English, might actually step up and potentially get a result. Not necessarily win, but at least get a result. Because you've got to remember, with the way the group format is now, Scotland have the potential to even lose this game and still manage to qualify for the knockout stages if they beat Croatia and end up being one of the best third place teams.
I mean, every game now for Scotland obviously is a massive game. From
a football point of view, I think, Demir, that night with Croatia playing Czech Republic, then England, Scotland, what I'm looking forward to the most is that Czech-Scotland game was as intense, constant, all-out attack from Scotland for so much of the game. Czechs got on top end of the first half and then obviously hit them on the counter in the second. But Scotland never let up. And so given how starkly it contrasts against the lack of intensity and the lack of impetus in the England-Croatia game, I just want to know, are Scotland and the Czechs just a good, in a boxing sense, just a good matchup in that they can throw haymakers at each other and just keep trading punches? Or...
suspenseful.
Or...
resume freeze from Teo.
Big pause. I was going to ask if the Scotland-England game, are England the perfect matchup for Scotland in the sense that England will just sit back and kind of cower away from the Scottish intensity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different kind of proposition entirely from playing Croatia, because Croatia want to play through the midfield all the time. And England were able to press very intensely in midfield, Calvin Phillips notably doing a lot of that, and Mason Mount is an exceptional presser of the ball as well. And that's where they got a lot of joy, was harassing Croatia as they tried to play short passes through the centre of the park. Whereas Scotland, on the other hand, are often happy to bypass midfield entirely. And, you know, they will be able to play over the top of the English press in the centre of the park. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how England deal with that, because that's an entirely different proposition and one that might actually threaten their style of defending more than Croatia did.
Mm. Anything more, Dummy, before we throw to a break? Anything top of mind?
No, I mean, we had the discussion earlier on in terms of any of the potential teams that lost in the first round, particularly any of the dark horses. Can they claw themselves back into the tournament? I mean, Turkey did lose their opening game in Euro 2008 to Portugal, and quite convincingly, and then ended up making the semi-finals by winning their next three games. Or, you know, they drew against Croatia but beat them on a penalty shootout to make the semi-finals. Also, another, you know, dark horse from that tournament, Russia, lost their opening game to Spain convincingly 4-1 and then made it all the way to semi-finals before again losing quite convincingly to Spain again. So I guess, you know, while they didn't look too impressive, I mean, can you really say apart from France, Portugal and Italy, can you really say that any of the other teams really looked that impressive either? I mean, the Netherlands didn't do really a great job in allowing the Ukrainians to come back into the contest. England, as I noted earlier, were quite unconvincing, in my opinion, against Croatia. And a lot of these teams that did impress, you know, you think to someone like Austria or even Belgium, that were playing against teams who were quite unconvincing and also quite substandard. So I think we'll get a better indication of where things are, as we normally do, following the end of the second round games. Sorry to sound like Captain Obvious there, but I think that there's still quite a lot to make of these respective teams.
Well, Teo, can you resolve that cliffhanger for us before we go to a break? Are Czech Republic and Scotland just a good boxing matchup, or
the trade punches against each other, or are they going to revert to maybe the character we expected before the tournament, which is Scotland will play like an underdog against England rather than the relentless attacking attempted force we saw against the Czechs, and then similarly, will Croatia flick the switch and play at a far higher intensity, and will the Czechs perhaps maybe having done their research on how England took on that game, think, well, maybe now we can try to dictate against the Czechs rather than maybe sitting back as we may have had to do. So, but just from a pure tactical point of view, these are the two games that I am looking forward to the most in the next round.
Well, let's take a quick break here on Twilight Football on FNR. On the other side, we might have a quick chat about the breaking A-League coaching news and preview the games coming up here in Euro 2020. Don't go anywhere. Football here on FNR.
Isn't it a slap?
Yeah, it's a nice little tune. It's a shame the people on the other end of the Zoom call can't hear it.
Can they not?
No, I don't think so. Teo Pelletieri and Damir Kulash are our guests today as we talk about Euro 2020. But we might take a brief A-League interlude here because there's been some big news breaking today that Alan Stajicic will be moving on from the Central Coast Mariners. Their fairy tale season coming to end in quite a disappointing fashion on and off the park. Damir, we've all been impressed by the job Stajicic has done at the Mariners this season. But, you know, again, it's another false dawn for this club that can't seem to catch a break.
Well, is it a false dawn? I think, you know, that's wholly dependent on who replaces Stajic and whether they're able to continue the good work that he's obviously imprinted at that club over the course of particularly the last season. I think what he's been there now for just over 2 years, and obviously the highlight of his spell is what they've been able to achieve this season, which is going from the last team of the ladder last year that collected 15 points from memory to a team that finished third and collected 42 points. So I think that, you know, it's a job well done for him. Now, the big question is who replaced him and how do you also replace a lot of the players that will be departing the club? We, of course, know Alu Kual won't be there next season. Neither will Danny De Silva, seemingly. They also do look set to appear set to lose Jack Clisby. There's rumours of Perth Glory is lurking there. Is someone like Ryan Tongik's value going to go up? Josh Nisbet has a very impressive season. They did lock in Kai Rolls today to a two-year deal, but it's really a question of, are they able to, you know, the players that do leave, are they able to replace them with anything better, which is always tough on the Mariners' budget. Although this season, I think what they showed was that you can also find real value in the NPL. Kual came through the NPL system, NPL 2, in fact, at the Golden Valley Suns. Steph Negro started 2020 at Green Gully, spent some time in quarantine in Darwin in order to be training with the Mariners. He did quite well. And also, although he primarily played most of his minutes in the first half of the season, I thought Jaden Casella looked like an A-League player when he did come into the fold. And there was a number of other youngsters that they had that have spent much of their career so far playing an NPL 2 level in New South Wales, the academy side, who looked quite at home in the A-League environment. So I think, you know, for the Mariners, the priority is make sure you replace Stajic with someone who's going to continue on his good work and ensure that the players who are departing are replaced by quality as well.
Teo, what do you think? Is the Mariners' revival over, or do you think they can keep the momentum going this next campaign without Stajic in charge?
The revival as we've known it is over. I think, in a sense, they go back to ground zero again, and now the next coaching appointment has to build them back up from ground zero. I do think that the demoralising factor, and Ray Gatt has tweeted at length tonight about the circumstances leading to this departure, saying that Stadge and Nahuel or Naz Orate, his assistant manager, weren't even entertained with a new offer. That says to me that it's going back to reset to zero. Look, if they think outside the square and they bring in someone who knows the NPL inside out, like, say, a Nick Tolios, who is a proper wheeler dealer and may not be – he's a former NSL player, let's not forget, wouldn't be the – you know, has won the NPL with Bentley Greens, albeit stepping into a well-oiled machine thanks to John Anastasiadis. But this is the sort of person who I think will have the temperament to handle the various foibles of people who make the jump from the NPL to the A-League, and also not simply put the line through someone based on a single trial, and might be a bit more patient and persistent with NPL-level talent. I think the real danger of hiring a system guy who's, you know, more of a career A-League type is that they will only take one look at an NPL player and put the line through them immediately and say not good enough. Do we know if Ernie Merrick wants to work again?
Come on.
I know that NPL clubs have gone and knocked on his door and obviously didn't add enough zeros to how many times they knocked in order to tempt him out of his slumber. I hardly think that would get Mariners fans excited. But you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if Mariners are selling the license, Mariners are moving the team. Those sort of stories now come right back to the forefront, because Stadge didn't just give them football, he gave them character and he gave them an identity. And it feels as though it's not just reset to zero in terms of the football, it is reset to zero in terms of the club's identity as well. It has all walked out the door today. And I think it's an interesting challenge for the APL with how committed they are to stringing this along, or whether we could potentially see a revival of a relocated franchise come back into the new cycle.
Obviously, there's going to be a few names thrown around. Damir, who comes to mind first when you're thinking of the best person to step in for Alan Stadge?
Look, I think Teo, left-field option, but Nick Tolios is a good NPL name. When you look at coaches that have worked in the A-League in the past, I mean, Mark Rudan is newly unemployed, so he might be someone who potentially puts his name into the mix. I think John Aloisi is another person that, you know, we see a lot of on our television screens. We, you know, think that... he potentially is deserving of another A-League opportunity. I would, you know, love to see him work in an A-League environment again. But it also, you know, you look at those two coaches, would they want to be working at a club like the Central Coast Mariners, where they wouldn't receive potentially the same level of support as they do in other clubs, judging by what Teo has indicated occurred with Stadic and Arate, which is disappointing here, because you'd think the first thing that the club would be looking to do following on from this season is to lock in Stadge's future long term. I think when you look at other potential NPL names, I think Ben Carnes established a really good reputation for himself up in Queensland with Olympic FC, and I do wonder with Ange Postecoglou's move to Celtic, what that means for the future of John Hutchison, his assistant at Yokohama F. Marinos, whether he's staying put in Japan, whether he might potentially even be joining Ange at Parkhead, or whether he's considering a return to Australia should he no longer be required at Yokohama.
Thought it was Ross Aloisi going to Celtic, wasn't it?
If only.
Well, that's the big rumour.
A few fisticuffs
sure
on
how...
the old firm sideline.
That'd be nice. We don't see those often enough.
Can I jump in? The other question is, where's Stadge going? Mm-hmm. If you looked at when ESPN and Stephanie Brands broke that story only a couple of hours ago, most of the replies and the quote tweets suggested the Western United gig or even Western Sydney Wanderers could be options. But I almost think that's looking inside the square a little bit too much. I remember when Stadge was the Matildas boss, I remember having a chat with him about how hard or how easy is it to get a gig in the college system in the United States, because these colleges spend a heap of money thanks to Title IX on their women's soccer programs, and they also have coaches that are tenured forever. The level of football is garbage. Stadge would instantly, I think, be one of the best coaches and would be a total program changer the moment he walks in. What is stopping a US college And if you're recruiting as a US college and you can point to someone who's been to World Cups, has been to an Asian Cup or two, has been a W League winner, and he said they're very hard jobs to get, but I would think with his reputation now somewhat restored and the rehabilitation he's done both on and off the field, having been really exemplary, I think that that could be – it's Australians don't give – just as I haven't done, don't give much respect to the college system, nor should we. But I do think that, you know, there's talk of Europe. Obviously, Joe Montemurro left Arsenal. There are all sorts of European club teams that have never really invested in women's football that now have potentially high-profile vacancies that could be filled. But I also think the US college system could be one to think about as well, especially given that Stature's kids – are now sort of in high school age, could be moving up to university age in the coming years.
Well, in the Twitch chat, we do have Nifty1203, who is the one and only Neil Simons, Agent Neil, coming through and saying, word coming in that Stadge left due to Charlesworth's unwillingness to put money into the team. Taya, do you think that kind of potentially not rules out the college avenue, but maybe makes us look elsewhere in the sense that Stadge is quite an ambitious manager? He wants to bring in new players every single season and really use Central Coast as a platform. Does that put him into the European conversation, or as you mentioned, the West United, Western Sydney Wanderers as well?
Here's the thing. The idea of Stadge coaching a Victorian-based team actually will break my brain. I can't bring myself to even process the idea that he would move. You know what? He might be a fly-in, fly-out coach. You might live in Sydney and fly down to training
just
every day.
Just do it over Zoom.
I can't see him living in Melbourne. I stand to be proven wrong, and I would love it. Kevin Keegan, I would love it if he moved to Melbourne. So who knows? I think if he stays in the A-League, maybe Western Sydney Wanderers is the shout. Damir, where do you think Alan Stadge is going? And especially if he and Nazarate are a package deal, because they were at the Matildas together as well, don't forget. Could that potentially affect your thinking on what comes next for the two of them?
Potentially. I mean, there's nothing clear-cut at the moment to suggest that he's been lined up to, you know, take over at West United. We know, you know, from all reports that Arthur Pappas is close to taking the Newcastle Jets gig, and that seemingly despite, you know, their unsuccessful nature of their season, that Carl Robinson will be back at the Wanderers next season. So I don't think that within the A-League that there's any vacancies available for him at the moment. That's not to say that there will be at a later point, but I do quite like the idea that he might potentially be angling for a European move to coach, you know, whether it's in the Women's Super League or whether it's elsewhere on the continent, or even potentially in the US college system, or even in the league over there, because, you know, he's quite highly regarded in a lot of circles within women's football. Not all circles, but definitely in a lot of circles. So he, you know, would definitely be an option that I think a lot of clubs, particularly top clubs in a women's game, would seriously consider.
I think that US college shout is an interesting one for the fact that it is such a stable position and they are so well paid. The coaches are almost the stars of the US college system as opposed to the sort of players who move on so quickly. Maybe I'm more thinking of basketball than soccer. But
I like the idea of saying Stadge is leading the varsity team to a victory over 2-0.
Yes, but what about the goalkeeper save percentage? That's the stat the Americans love.
Absolutely. Would he be tempted by a return to the international scene, Teo, do you think? I mean, the Olympics is allegedly coming up, as long as that goes ahead, and we've got a Women's World Cup here in Australia. I mean, wouldn't Stadge love nothing more than to win the Women's World Cup for a different country in Australia? That would be the ultimate revenge arc, would it not?
Oh, that is a storyline only Vince McMahon could engineer, I think. The heel heat... of that storyline. Yeah, you know what, Josh? That's still more likely than Stadge coaching a team in Victoria. But with that said, I don't know what vacancies we've got, mainly because so many women's international teams just can't get their teams together to play. The cost and sort of arduousness of staging international football has become so difficult and so expensive that many of these teams preparing for the Olympics are, you know, it's not just New Zealand. I think there's an AFCON coming up and many of their countries just flat out aren't assembling teams and aren't playing, and they will go to the tournament stone cold, and their first sessions and their first games will be in an AFCON. So, look, I don't know what vacancies are open. I think if it is a return to women's football, it will probably be in Europe. And otherwise, you know what? It could be as simple. I think the Occam's razor is that it's one of these A-League vacancies. I mean, Dabir mentioned Arthur Pappas looking good for the job at Newcastle. It would be such a kick in the guts for the Mariners if Stadge was just going up the freeway. And that would be fold your club time, I think. If the Mariners are going to let that happen, then they really should just say, all right, we are going to play in red. We are going to move to Sydney. We're done in Gosford. It's over.
Central Coast Devils, I'm calling for. Is it just the Sydney Devils, the North Sydney Devils?
Yeah, that's North Shore Devils time, I think, if that happens. While we're talking women's football, we may as well mention the Matildas. Without notice, Teo, some less than impressive results against European and now Scandinavian opposition, a draw against Sweden overnight. What have you made of the Matildas' performance? I mean, we've been barraged by football at the moment, so I don't blame you if you haven't seen too much of it. But has at least the Denmark sort of rally in the second half given you any optimism?
No, because I think we got it wrong at selection. I think either Tony G or his advisors are just getting it wrong. They're not picking players with the right short-term mindset for the Olympics coming up. I'm not putting any sort of currency in the rally. The team was 3-0 down, so we don't know what Denmark may have clocked off at their end. You know, I think we'll be okay at the Olympics. Obviously, we won't win, but I think that, again, the team needs to carve out an identity, and right now the world's out to get us, backs to the wall. Who are we to judge the Matildas' performances? I'm not sure that's the identity they want to create for themselves. They need to be warm, they need to be broad, and they need to encompass all opinions, because when you are the host nation of a World Cup where soccer is not the number one sport, and I say soccer just to trigger you in the context of that sentence, then you need to put up with every garbage opinion of everyone, because those neutrals are allegedly the ones you are trying to turn into bandwagon fans.
Ouch. You know what else triggered me, Taya? We're seeing Emily Van Egmond on her 100th cap play at the base of midfield again. We still don't know her natural position. It's still not clicking after 100 appearances in green and gold. Just shrug. Shrug emoji.
Yeah. Jose Mourinho.gif.
If I speak. Oh, dear. What about the Socceroos then? Dami, I can bring you in on this maybe. A 1-0 win against Jordan overnight. Fairly workmanlike dispatching of lower quality opposition in these qualifying games. But 8 wins from 8. And we could be facing Japan or Iran in the next round of World Cup qualifying. I don't suppose you have a preference on who you might like to draw.
Gee, Josh, you're assuming there that I didn't watch the Matildas game ahead of the Socceroos game. Gee, I'm offended. I didn't actually watch the Socceroos game either. But I think
people did, unless they were working on it.
Did you watch it?
No, I was watching the Euros, mate.
When did you get up?
I was awake while it was going on. I was watching Hungary Portugal in front of a capacity crowd. It was too good to resist. But you know, we're going into the toughies now with pot two. We've been drawn in, so we can't play against South Korea. It's going to be Japan or Iran as the first seeded opponent. The third seed is either Saudi Arabia or the UAE. Then it's Iraq or China, Syria or Oman, and Vietnam or Lebanon. So I think there are some pretty clear choices who I'd rather have in the Socceroos group if they're going to have an easy passage. If we drew, you know, Syria, Vietnam, Iraq, Saudi Arabia and Japan, I think we might be in for a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I know that we always fall into the trap of saying, oh, we'll beat them. The only team that falls into that category is Lebanon. Everyone else is a potential banana skin. I think the crucial thing here is, are we going to have the right border restrictions to play our games at home, or are we going to have to play them at neutral venues? And if so, can those neutral venues be in Europe? Would the AFC let the Socceroos play home AFC qualifiers in London rather than, say, Malaysia? Damir, who do you want us to draw?
In terms of from pot one, I'd probably be more inclined to draw Iran, irrespective of the fact that we haven't played Iran in qualifying since 97. So it might be a bit of an entry unknown.
Straight in the heart, Damir. You'd really triggered everybody there.
In terms of, you know, the logistical aspect of it, although we did play Iraq in the 2018 qualifiers in Iran. But, yeah, I just think that the Japanese are at a bit of a stronger level than where the Iranians are. I noted they had a few issues with Wilmot post-Kirosh, but now they seem to be on the mend that they did beat Iraq last night to, you know, confirm passage into the next round. So, look, it's going to be tough either way. You look at some of these teams in Asia, they're improving. And I know that's cliche to say that they're slowly closing the gap, but, you know, in the case of you look at a top three, I mean, UAE, Birdman Malik, it would, you know, be quite the story if it was to coach an upset win against the Socceroos, given how little we got from him at the 2018 World Cup. You also see, you know, Vietnam out of really nowhere coming up to, you know, top, they were first up until last night, until the UAE took over in first place. But they actually finished ahead of both local rivals, Malaysia, who had a much improved team with a few naturalised players, including a couple of Aussies, and Brendan Gan and Matthew Davies. And also Thailand, who seemed to be making quite a bit of progress in the 2014 and 2018 World Cup qualifiers, only to be brought back down to earth in this one and have a disappointing campaign. The fact that Lebanon has made it suggests that they're improving. Syria came almightily, you know, within millimetres of knocking Australia out of the 2018 World Cup qualifiers. So they're another team to watch. And, you know, you can never also discount the Saudis. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting times ahead on the road to Qatar next year. And as Tao alluded to, I reiterate what he said, it's going to be really interesting to see what's going to happen with the home games, because it doesn't look like Australia's border restrictions will end anytime soon.
Well, Australia's progression to World Cups recently has been on the back of home form. So it's going to be very challenging to play at neutral venues. On Lebanon, Damir, they qualified ahead of Turkmenistan and Sri Lanka and North Korea, who withdrew from qualifying. So I don't think it was a particularly tough draw for Lebanon in Group H.
Yeah, you know what? If they qualified for the Cricket World Cup through that path, I'd be very impressed.
Yeah, it's those Turkmenistani cricketers you got to worry about. Oh dear. Well, do we have any thoughts on the way the Socceroos have been playing recently? Are there any conclusions or lessons that we can draw from this most recent batch of qualifying games, other than Aiden Hrustic is a baller? Anyone want to jump in? Ed, Tao, Damir? No? Yeah. Shaking of heads?
I think given, you know, you mentioned Lebanon's lack of quality opposition in qualifying, you know, you could extend the same to Australia. Mm. I was a bit disappointed that, you know, for example, against Nepal, only a 3-0 victory against an inherently inferior team. And, you know, it's not always the scoreline. You've got to look to the football that they're playing. But I think you brought up an interesting stat in, which, you know, I do apologise if you mentioned in previous shows, but they're, you know, outperforming their XG. And they're also not really creating a lot of, you know, clear-cut goal-scoring opportunities, which I do wonder, against more quality opposition, will that cost Australia, particularly on the road? Because as you've correctly highlighted, Australia's path to previous World Cups has been sown in impressive home form. There's rarely ever a home defeat, and when it is, it's generally in games that don't really matter once Australia's already progressed either to the next stage. So yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how this team looks like in the remaining fixtures later this year when the really tough part of World Cup qualifiers commences.
And can I just say, there would be a cruel, cruel irony if after 2 decades of waiting, we finally get Iran in a competitive game. and it's at a neutral venue.
Mm.
We need next time we can march back to the MCG and have a do over. We need to do it. And I actually, even for the football purposes aside, I hope we draw Japan. We can't draw Iran like this. Not when we can't have a home crowd.
Not like this,
please.
I am concerned that we're only scoring off set pieces. That's my main concern. I don't think we can rely on big Harry Suter to nut one in every time. I know he's only going to be so effective for so long. I think his hot streak has to end at some point. And then where are the goals going to come from? That is my question.
No more Harry Suter nuts for us.
No, unfortunately. Would we play it at the MCG again, Teo? Do you think, like, restrictions aside, would it be at Amy Park in front of 35 instead of...
No, I think this is folklore. This is a game that could get 65-70 purely based on the fact that everyone who knows football in this country will want to go back and put the demons to rest.
Also, I think a big thing that we have to kind of put behind us is the fact that the largest... or the most important football match we've seen at the MCG for probably the last 5 years was Liverpool versus Melbourne victory. I think we have to overcome that eventually. The MCG.
Hang on, Ed, it was absolutely the Argentina-Brazil game.
Oh, excuse me.
Yes.
Or Atletico Madrid versus Roma. That in the Champions Cup.
Champions Cup, the storied competition.
Mm.
Which member of the local Code Wars mafia will storm onto the field and cut the goal net up?
Tom Brown.
I was going to say Jonathan Brown as a stint for Nova. He'll come running on, handing everyone Sharon.
This is a sponsored segment.
Here, take it.
All right, I reckon that's all we've got time for tonight. Gentlemen, thank you for bearing with us through our technical difficulties in setup, and thank you for your insights on the Euros and on Australian football. I think what we've learnt tonight is that Stajic will win the World Cup with another team in 2023.
He just won't step foot in Victoria while doing it.
No, it'll just let his team play on their own interstate, and Bert van Marwijk's knocking us out of World Cup qualifying. Good night.
Good night. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
What a nice way to sign off.